Good day, listeners. This is your host, Michael Martins, with the Martins Critical Review, broadcasting this morning from another bluebird sunny day here in West Kelowna, British Columbia. In today's program, we welcome back our friend and fellow freedom fighter, Vincent Gerses, to continue analyzing the current COVID situation unfolding all around us. For those of you who have not yet heard the previous episodes which featured Vincent, I suggest you give episodes 48, 52, and 63 a listen. Vincent is a 30-year veteran and now retired senior constable of the Ontario Provincial Police. For the sake of brevity, and his complete and impressive bio will be available in the show notes. Vincent, welcome back to the show. Always an honor to speak with you, and thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me back, Michael. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Yes, yes. So it's been a little bit more than 2 months now since we last spoke, and I've been searching for a glimmer of hope in Canada here that our situation is improving. I have yet, however, to catch a glimpse of this. Do you have any positive shifts that you can share with the listeners?
I wish I did. Unfortunately, like yourself, I see things continuing to sink into the abyss. I really don't have any good news for the listeners.
Yeah, and that's a shame. I mean, and unfortunately, that's really where it's at. You know, I kind of keep looking for something which might shift my opinion as to where this is going, and I've yet to see it. So that's I'm saddened to hear that you don't have anything either. So that is disappointing.
It seems like we only have bad things to talk about, and I don't believe that it's our perspective. I try to be an optimistic individual and always look for the brighter things. But I think when we're talking about politics or where this narrative is going, the news does not appear to be good or encouraging, certainly.
No, it doesn't. And there has been some stunning and alarming decisions coming out of the Canadian Parliament as late, or should I call it the Assemblée Nationale du Poder Populaire of Canada, which is the Cuban version of their National Assembly. You know, first off, Vote 118, which look to suspend federal elections until the scandemic is over. And in a conversation I had yesterday with a number of very well-off and intelligent men, they had not heard about this vote, and they contacted their accounting and legal advisors who had also not heard about this. And for those folks who haven't heard about what Vote 118 was, this was brought forward by the traitor Alan Terrien of the Bloc Québécois, and the specific text of the motion reads, the House reminds the government that a general election was held in October 2019 and sadly notes that more than 1.3 million Canadians, including almost 360,000 Quebecers, have been infected with COVID-19 and that nearly 25,000 people have died as a result. And in the opinion of the House, holding an election during a pandemic would be irresponsible, and it is the responsibility of the government to make every effort to ensure that voters are not called to the polls as long as this pandemic continues. So shockingly, this motion passed 327-1, with the only dissenting vote belonging to the Patriot Derek Sloan. How do you interpret this motion, and what does this really mean for Canada?
Well, I interpret this as never let a crisis go to waste. That's the first thing that comes to mind. You know, there are many opportunists utilizing this crisis to further the agenda and to stay in power. And I think that's there's no question, you know, that the first mission of any government agency is to maintain its position, to stay in power. And this is certainly an opportunity to do just that.
Sure. And I mean, this is a very interesting motion because it essentially has suspended democratic elections in Canada for an indefinite period. Because as we've seen since March of 20, you know, the term as long as this pandemic continues, to me, is the most open-ended statement I've ever encountered coming from a government.
Absolutely. I mean, there was no necessity for this bill whatsoever. Absolutely no necessity. First of all, if things were to progress in a more substantial, serious matter, this issue could have always been brought forward at a later date. And there's no necessity for it now. And again, it doesn't take into consideration the data that we have been speaking about for over a year now. So, first of all, the severity is not there, the emergency is not there, the necessity is not there. And yet, most surprisingly, is not just the bill, but the number of people who adopted that bill. It is disgusting, to say the least.
Yes, and I'm glad you brought that up because, really, I believe that the job of the opposition, and in this case, I would consider that to be the conservative party, their job is to oppose pretty much everything the government does, unless it's in the best interest of Canadians. And as long as Canadians can go and shop at a big box store and line up and wear a mask and do their shopping, what's the difference about casting their vote? I mean, that's the fundamentally most important concept in a democratic system is the ability of the citizens to vote. And this has been removed and has been endorsed by the opposition, which is, it just simply doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, it is yet another very interesting eye-opener for us as Canadians, for all Canadians to look at and say, regardless of what the bill was, the fact that it had come about, the fact that we had that number of MPs voting in favor of the bill, we'll call it unanimous with the exception of Derek Sloan. Again, I love to use C.L. Lewis's quote, when the majority of when it appears that the whole world is running toward a cliff, the one individual running in the opposite direction appears to be insane. And yet, that is best portrayed by the vote that had just taken place. You have the vast majority, we'll call it essentially the unanimous number of MPs doing something that is not in the best interest of Canadians. And that would be the first question that you would ask yourself. Is this in the best interest of all Canadians?
Yes. And, I guess if you're toeing the line that there's a deadly pandemic underway, then perhaps. But then if it's that deadly, then nobody should be leaving their homes or going to stores. And I mean, this is just yet another indication of this sort of Orwellian doublespeak where nothing makes any sense and nothing is based in reason or logic.
Absolutely. And again, we continue to perhaps with your audience that may be tuned in as to the information that you've been providing over this entire length of time, I would say that there's some indication that more and more people are waking up. But there's a difference between waking up and actually getting out of bed. And that's the necessity here is you can be awake, but you need to get out of bed.
And in your observations, out in your neck of the woods there, how many people were aware of this bill or this motion passing? Because out this way, it seems, I'm the one who's been spreading the word, and many people have simply not heard of this.
Well, it seems to be the same individuals that we tend to talk to or share information with and have detailed conversations about, people that are open to conversations, seem to be aware and understanding because we're following similar news feeds and information. But if you're going to be the CBC's CNN type of individual who's following more so the mainstream information, then that's not going to be discussed in any length of time or detail or in brought forward in any type of panic or severity or interest that we see it as.
So a very low penetration then in terms of that information amongst the general population.
Well, that's correct. That's correct. You'll hear about it in your own personal circles, but amongst the population, just like most issues that you've been speaking about for the last year, the general population doesn't seem to be very aware, or if they are aware, they would perceive this as a good thing.
Okay. And then next, we're on to the troubling matter of Bill C-10, which is the Internet Censorship Bill. And here, the vote in Parliament at least was separated somewhat along party lines, with the traitors in the Liberal, NDP, and Bloc and Green parties all demonstrating their communistic tendencies, and the Conservative Party all opposed. The vote was 196 to 112. I'm assuming you've researched this bill somewhat. What are your thoughts on this bill, and what are the ramifications once this becomes ratified and imposed upon Canadian society?
Well, I think the most interesting takeaway that I've had from Bill C-10, and it's very minor, and it was in one of the paragraphs describing the outline of Bill C-10. It spoke essentially, I'm not going to paraphrase exactly, but essentially it spoke of bringing truth to Canadians, the necessity for maintaining strengths within our mainstream media and our legacy media. And that there would be some type of a disadvantage from internet content over broadcast content, and that the legacy system has brought truth to Canadians, and that the legacy system needs to be kept strong in maintaining its form of programming. So I love those two keys that came together in the same sentence. So we have bringing truth to Canadians, which it does not and has not progressively over the last number of years, and to maintain the nature of programming. And I'm gonna interpret that word programming probably as you would. It's really the conditioning and setting a narrative for all Canadians, and they don't want to lose that. I mean, it's so important for a government to maintain power, is to give you the perception that what they're telling you is true, and telling you that it's necessary for us to provide you with this programming. The programming could be another word for indoctrination, but I also like to look at it as the defining methodology of the nature of the message. So it's propaganda or a direction to follow. Here's the direction we want you to follow. And we're gonna put it out there. So if we don't have control over that, if we lose control over that to other corporations or other business or other entities or other speakers who are louder and become more popular in their messaging, then we will lose control of our narrative.
And of course, this has been sort of pushed under the guise of preventing hate speech or this type of discussion to protect people's feelings. And it's essentially it's a throttle on the internet, a control on free speech. I mean, if as long as I'm not actually uttering hate speech and looking to call violence upon other people, I mean, there's got to be obviously limits on what somebody can say or publish. But in the absence of that type of behavior, I mean, one should be able to speak freely their mind. And yes, there may be repercussions. People may attack you. They may disagree with your opinion. But again, one of the other fundamental tenets of a democracy is the ability of citizens to express their feelings and their opinions.
Yeah, that's correct. Now, I know there have been some additional amendments made to the bill, and I'm not aware of the details of what those amendments were in the version that I was reading or looking up. But I think the majority is really focused on content, not content providers, but service providers. So it's really the internet service providers that they're looking to enforce upon. And also the network providers. So things like Spotify, YouTube, other Netflix, other larger content providers. And essentially, my understanding of the bill is it's really making them the enforcement arm of the content. And there could be an indication, there's some speculation, there could be an indication that some of these content providers may just pull out of Canada. They may say that if I have a $7 million or $10 million fine, that can be levied against me because I can't adhere to the standards or restrictions that you're requesting, then maybe we're just going to pull out of Canada. Maybe it's just becoming too restrictive. But it certainly does speak volumes to the playing field between radio broadcast, RF broadcast versus web content. And we know that web content is growing very, very quickly in comparison to RF broadcast. And like anything, it's like VHS versus beta versus CD, DVD. The formats, the contents change, technology changes. And I think people in general are less apt than they were 20, 30, 50 years ago to sit in front of their television as they are to sit in front of their computer monitor or tablet. And so, the life is changing, the methodology is changing, technology is changing, and the government's trying to package this as maintaining a level playing field, when in fact, the way you read it, it is phrased in a way that can be interpreted that this is a good thing for Canadians. But in fact, anytime there's censorship and limitations to the markets for people getting on the markets, and let's face it, if you had a channel or if you had a content you're trying to provide and it's growing and it's what people want, then allow it to continue, allow it to grow. It's not just a question of censorship of speech, it's a question of censorship of business and business modeling. So all in all, it is suppression. It really is suppression and wanting to maintain status quo.
Right. I mean, and almost in a way like the Great Red Firewall of China. I mean, I see some parallels here. I mean, this is obviously not as blatant, but once the CRTC has a set of standards in place for these ISPs and other providers that they must adhere to, I mean, we essentially have slipped in this Canadian firewall of information.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up the CRTC. The CRTC, what really comes to mind was in our last municipal election that took place in Toronto a few years back, there was a candidate running for a mayoral position in Toronto, and her name was Faith Goldie. And I don't know Faith Goldie personally, but I had been following some of the work she had been doing. She used to be with Rebel Media at one point, and in the city of Toronto, she had developed a substantial following of individuals, and she was speaking to truth as we do quite frequently. And she was doing very well in the polls for the mayoral run against John Tory. And what had happened was there was quite an expose about her trying to get some airtime to run some ads on the local news stations. And the CRTC, if you were to read its regulations on political candidates, they are required to be afforded an equal amount of airtime within the broadcast agencies. And she had submitted a check to one of the news broadcast, one of the broadcasting agencies. I think it was the CTV. It could have been Global News, but I think it was CTV. Anyways, one of the Canadian content providers, news providers, and she had submitted for some airtime for some commercial time. They initially accepted her check, and then she received a call saying her check's being returned, and they apologized, but they can't work with her. They're not allowed to broadcast any of her content. So she had struck a court challenge very quickly to have that heard. First, I believe making an argument to the CRTC that that went against policy, and the CRTC wouldn't touch it. They wouldn't touch it, and it was a very hot issue. And then, as she walked into a courtroom with some lawyers to have that resolved very quickly, because the elections were coming very quickly, the judge said, "I'm not going to hear this case," and just tossed it out. So, what does that tell you? If you're paying attention to this, what does that tell you about political manipulation and the ability to advertise or get some equal airtime as the laws or rules would apply? And it clearly says we have a system that is corrupted. We have a system that doesn't have a mechanism in place, and we are clearly steering certain candidates forward or pushing them forward on the agenda and purposely withholding other candidates that are growing in popularity. That was a big eye-opener for me on how the CRT was operating and how the courts within the city of Toronto were operating on not wanting to allow justice in this particular case. And as it turns out, we ended up with Mayor John Tory in the city of Toronto. And that has turned into a terrible, terrible debacle with the manner in which he's ruling the city.
Interesting. And when did this occur, Vincent?
That was the I'm going to say that was about 2 to 3 years ago.
Okay.
It was
Okay.
during the last municipal election in the city of Toronto.
Interesting. Well, it's not quite as draconian as throwing your political opponent into jail, as in the case of Kevin Johnson in Calgary. I mean, I think as
It's
far as
very similar. It's very similar.
yeah, I mean, as far as I know, he's still in jail, although some of that also stems from his verbal threats to AHS, which when I saw him do that, he's a bit of he's quite a boisterous character, but I think that pushed things too far. I mean, when you start threatening people on air, you've probably pushed it too far. I mean, threatening lawsuits or civil action, that's all fine, but when you say you're going to go to their house armed and, that's you've kind of entered the wingnut category at that point, unfortunately.
Yeah, some people do go too far. There's no question. There's no question. And that's interesting because that information needs to come out. Some people that don't understand the details behind that would not see it that way. But you really do need to look at all the details. There are things that, there's free speech is a wonderful thing in this country, but there are limits and we should all know what they are and work within them. And I don't think under the current category of free speech, I don't think anybody would really dispute the fact that threats of violence and intimidation are not something that we would allow in this country. That's just not acceptable.
No, and nor should we. And if you or I are having a drive somewhere, or sitting having a pint, and we're having a personal discussion, and we're fed up with something, and we come up with we'd like to lay some hands on so and so or punch him in the mask. I mean, that's one thing, but to broadcast that to your audience and make claims in the media, I mean, now you've pushed it too far.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, as much as some of those individuals potentially deserve a smackdown, I mean, you have to be, especially if you're looking to political office, aspire to political office. I mean, you need to be a bit more diplomatic than that.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
And something that we haven't actually put on an agenda for conversation today would be the comment that you made about sitting together and having a pint and having conversation. That just quickly takes me off into the category of I'm very much enjoying my new phone, my new de-Googled phone, and the amount of surveillance capitalism that is taking place, or shall I just call it blank surveillance, is when you really understand how much information is being gleaned off you during any conversation or any movement. From individuals, the amount of technology used to track and
Correct.
surveil you is incredible. And there is a new system that's rolling out now. Perhaps at some point we can do a whole show on it. And it's about the Bluetooth mesh network now. So the IoT, Internet of Things, every device now is intercommunicating and always reporting back to either Google, Facebook. Google, Facebook are the primary ones, and Amazon as well, in constant surveillance tracking. Every Bluetooth device is always intercommunicating with every other Bluetooth device, just recording your MAC address and then always sending it back to their servers. So you're always being surveilled. If you decide to walk your dog at night and go down the neighborhood, different Alexas are gonna hone in on your phone walking by and say, Michael Martin's just happened to walk by my house at this time. And then
Wow, there's.
Palantir picks all that up and makes it available to government agencies.
For sure. And there's, I mean, so a couple things there. Number one, nobody should ever have their personal name on their phone. I've used a pseudonym for a long time. Location services is always off. Never download any apps onto your phone. If you want to be on Facebook, access it via the browser. It's easy to type in, www.facebook.com. You can still access it. You have a little less functionality, but they also have far less functionality. Turn your Bluetooth and your Wi-Fi off when you leave the home. Unless you're in the car and you need to your car phone. Same thing goes for Instagram. Don't download the app. It's essentially spyware. If you want to access Instagram, you can do so via the browser. Delete WhatsApp. It's a Facebook tool. You've got Signal, Telegram. There's a bunch of other ones that are less invasive. And if you need your phone as a GPS tool, then enable your location services for that app on an as-needed basis. And once you finish, turn it off. I mean, it's otherwise you are simply providing data. And for God's sake, don't download Apple Pay and all the rest of that stuff. It's just one more layer of surveillance. And with that new move by the Canadian Parliament, or I guess it was more the PMO's office, directing banks to allow StatsCan to anonymously, which I don't believe, analyze people's purchasing patterns. They've done that, I think, to see how quickly they need to introduce a digital currency because of the loss due to the cash economy of people either avoiding sales taxes or income taxes and so forth. And I know I heard a either heard or read an article recently talking about, actually it was an interview by Andreas Antonopoulos, who's one of the big Bitcoin promoters. And one of his reasons he said he moved into Bitcoin is because of the government surveillance, whether it's whether it's Visa or MasterCard or actually the government looking at what you're doing, they have tremendous influence over your life, or can, with the more and more data they're collecting. So people need to be aware of this. Unfortunately, particularly amongst the millennial generation, they're so entrenched in their smartphones that asking them to do what I've just described, you would receive blank stares. And I could never do that. How would my life function without all my apps and my phone plugged into my face, right?
Yeah, quite good actually. I'm finding with my D Google phone, life is much better. Now, one thing we didn't touch on is what happened this week in Ireland. The Garda now has permission through legislation that if they approach you and say, "I want your cell phone and I want the password for your cell phone," you are now required by law in Ireland to provide the password for your cell phone to the police in Ireland.
Unreal. Well, one of the strange things that Apple did when they went away from the fingerprint access, and most people have their facial recognition. So regardless whether if you've been foolish enough to provide facial recognition to your phone, if you are apprehended, they'll simply put your phone in front of your face and now they have access to it. So that was a tricky move because I know, I guess it was a few years back now, 3 years ago, where the FBI asked Apple to unlock that phone and they said for privacy reasons we can't. And then suddenly the fingerprint functionality was gone and it was facial recognition. So I think there was some backroom dealings that occurred there to allow that technology to happen.
Yeah, exactly. And I find that the downside to Apple is with an Android system, Google can be removed. So you can separate the two and strip Google and all of its surveillance mechanisms out of the Android system. But you can't do that with an Apple. There's no way to dig into the operating software and remove Facebook or Google or Amazon, the three biggest tech companies that are surveilling everything. Of course, that's all being delivered to Palantir, and Palantir is providing it to the government. So,
So, is Palantir like another echelon type system, or I haven't heard of that.
yes, Palantir is probably the and it's named after the all-seeing eye in Lord of the Rings, the Palantir all-seeing eye. And so what Palantir does is, Facebook, Google, Amazon, and all other agencies sell the data to third parties. And Palantir vacuums it up like the world's greatest vacuum cleaner and just vacuums up everything from everyone, from all of them, and then can separate all that information by user. And so everything that has been vacuumed up will go into a file under Michael Martin's. And then when your government wants to know where Michael Martin's is at this very moment, or, let's take a good snapshot look at Michael Martin's, they can deal with Palantir, and Palantir will provide everything about you that has been online, Facebook content, anything you've ever posted under anything you've ever put on the web under your name that has an affiliation to your name. So, of course, if you were able to log into some software or some program utilizing a different name anonymously, well, then that doesn't have direct content or direct pathway to you. But if you've logged in under accounts, so you could go to certain sites, but if you've been logged in under Google and gone into certain sites, now it's all connected to you. And you know, the government can either you look at you individually, or it can run AI algorithms to say, who should we be concerned about this week? You know, give us the top 1,000 people in Canada that we need to be concerned about. And
Oh, I'm sure you and I are on that list.
yeah, well,
Unfortunately.
I'm sure it has a lot to do with not only what you post, but what you talk about. And of course, what you're thinking, because you express certain viewpoints. Every like, every dislike, every thumbs up, thumbs down will paint a picture to the algorithm of how you feel about certain things politically.
Yeah, that's interesting. So yeah, that is the evolution of the echelon system then, where they're, now really being able to paint a very robust picture of people if they're not taking precautions to sort of clean up the breadcrumbs that they're leaving on the internet.
Well, are you talking about Echelon, the software, or are you speaking more metaphorically?
No,
Because
yeah,
there is a software called Echelon.
Yeah, the I
And
think CSIS has been using it to sort of monitor buzzwords. I mean, obviously, if you're talking about bombs, that might put a ping on, and then that starts to record it. And if it continues, I mean, I'm sure you know the system.
yeah, it's well, Echelon isn't something that I didn't discover Echelon through my police background. That's not something that we delved into. It was the first in the series of the Bourne series. I think it was the second movie where they mentioned Project Echelon, and he's being tracked. He came up on the radar on Echelon, and I thought, is this like a Hollywood joke or something? You know, we don't really have systems like that. And then go ahead and look up Echelon, and you'll see it's something that's available to the Five Eyes nations, and it's a global telephone-based, cell-based monitoring system that monitors every single phone
Everything.
call in the world, and it just vacuums it all up. And of course, like you said, if you mention certain words, you'll set off certain flags. And
Yes.
so Echelon does exist. It's a real thing that's vacuuming up voice data across the world.
Yeah. And I would add, based on my one of my guests, Dr. Tammy Nemeth, who informed me that Zoom is something which in her household is not permitted to be loaded on any device, cannot enter the home. And from the intelligence services in the UK, they have said that Zoom essentially is a CCP spyware. And you should never be on it, should never have it on any of your devices. It is a listening tool, and they are looking to analyze everything, right from what they see through the camera to what's being spoken. And if you imagine, the amount of corporate intelligence that could be gleaned from Zoom, it's astronomical. I mean, how many confidential conversations are being had on Zoom right now across the world? Hundreds of thousands, I mean, with very sensitive information potentially. And so that's why I've gone to the WebEx platform, which has a much more robust encryption system. And I guess it's U US developed and owned, and it may be the NSA listening to you, but it's not the CCP. So
So that's it. That's an interesting point. I've had this conversation with several individuals, and I would say not thinking on the corporate spectrum, but on the individual spectrum. Would you rather have the CCP listening in on your private conversations, or would you rather have CSIS listening in on your private conversations, being a Canadian citizen?
Well, I mean, all my conversations at this point are probably fodder to be thrown into a gulag, simply, based on my political affiliations at this point, or political viewpoints. I would suggest yours are as well. So at this point, I mean, I would have a fundamental opposition from the CCP spying on me, and that maybe is a little less so for the local authorities to maintain law and order domestically. But I mean, yeah, I mean, at this point, as Ragmeet Singh has characterized us, we are right-wing extremists that are probably white supremacists and God knows whatever, litany of garbage that came out of his mouth. So, I wonder what the corporate culture is at, places like the CSIS or NSA. I mean, are they, woke jokes there as well, or are they more of our sort of mentality or mindset where they're looking at this and maybe scratching their heads and wondering, you know, what the hell's going on. I mean, I would imagine certainly of the older guard, you know, hopefully their brains are still intact, but you know, who knows? I mean, you may have to be part of that affiliation to even obtain those positions. I don't know. I mean, you might have a better idea there than I do.
Well, first of all, I would say that if the CCP was listening and monitoring my conversations, even if there was something in that conversation that shouldn't be said, which there usually isn't, what are they going to do about it? They're on the other side of the world, and they really don't care. But your local government, you're a bigger threat to your local government by speaking the truth. We could speak the truth about the CCP, and there's nothing they can do about it. And if they try to reach out, you're on the other side of the world. But your local government, as things start to become more and more unjust, we start to lose rights on a substantial level, on a progressive scale that we've seen in the last 60 and 18 months. At what point is this now going to start being used against you? And we can see that it's already being used for individuals that are speaking out, people that speak the truth. The amount of surveillance being done on them. So you can use Chris Skye as a really good example of that. There's somebody speaking the truth. He has done nothing wrong legally, and yet here's a surveilled individual that is being harassed continuously because he speaks the truth.
Yes, sure, and of course wound up on a no-fly list, which you know he may never get off. I mean, that he may have just limited his ability to travel, you know, on an airplane for the foreseeable future, if not the rest of his life. Because
Right. And this is for someone who speaks the truth.
sure. So another development out of our illustrious parliament there has been Bill C-36, which obviously was sitting in the wings, ready to be launched with the approval of C-10. And this one, to me, as I dive into it, is probably the scariest of all these new measures. And it's a bill which essentially determines what is Canadian and what Canadians can consume as information. To sh essentially shape the minds and attitudes of Canadians moving forward. Your thoughts on this?
I think it can be sold and packaged with some sense of appreciation from some Canadians to say that, yeah, we don't want to be influenced by outside sources. So it's okay to be influenced by inside sources. It's just not okay to be influenced by outside sources. So we'll call it, it has to be Canadian content. We'll decide what Canadian content is, and we won't allow any interference from outside sources, but we will then continue to influence you internally.
Right. So again, more information that there are five genders and you know, the rest of that kind of woke gobbledygook that they keep promoting. And of course, you know, one of the other effects that I think that will have is again limiting the discussion of climate alarmism. You know, I had a guest on earlier this week that you know, clearly was in the climate alarmism camp, and it was a little entertaining to see, especially her facial reactions to my statements that, you know, you're pr proved to me that CO2 causes warming. You know, well, I don't know what scientists you've been speaking to. Well, only the greatest physicists on the planet Earth, but you know, that's great if you choose to believe that narrative. Didn't really want to debate it. I challenged her to, you know, bring forward three of your favorite scientists, and I'll bring forward three of mine, and we'll have a debate on the subject, which I'm sure will not happen. You know, and that conversation was surrounding the destruction of Canadian forests for the wood pellet industry, which is 100% driven by the false narratives of CO2. So, you know, at what point does that discussion now become un-Canadian? And the discussion that, hey, you know, maybe, you know, how is Canada going to pay this massive debt that the government has incurred? Maybe we should get that the oil sands fired up again. You know, perhaps we need some refining capacity or at least some pipeline capacity. Let's talk about Keystone XL. I mean, are all those subjects going to be off the table? I mean, where does this end? I mean, this again is like the motion 118 of limiting elections until the pandemic is over. I mean, this is again another open-ended bill that has, you know, really at this point unknown consequences or unknown impact.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, if it wasn't for online content and the ability to have debate and discussion on all sides of the spectrum. If it wasn't for that, we would never get ourselves out of some of the messes that we've gotten ourselves into. And one of the greatest takeaways from this pandemic, watching it unfold over the last 16, 18 months, is the manner in which the censorship has really taken hold, the manner in which the narrative has rolled out, similar to the way the narrative of global climate change has rolled out, in that there was the demonization of anyone who went against that main narrative. There was censorship of anyone who went against that narrative. And now, when we see how our members of parliament are voting, and nobody's out of step, everybody must maintain conformity and step. So it's been a learning experience for us, but it's also been a great, tremendous learning experience for the government to say, we can see how the contrary opinions get out. We can see how it needs to be controlled. We could see how we need to tighten this up. We could see how our ministers are now in lockstep with the bills that we present. And so I see a rapid acceleration of more and more bills coming out because this government is going to put everything it wants on its birthday list, birthday wish list, and put it all out there, bill after bill after bill. And you're going to have everybody following along in lockstep and just saying, we can't say no. Whatever the government puts out there, we'll just say yes. And it's a communist manifesto's dream to just have compliance like this. And while at the same time we're being further censored, and any voices like yours that come out and bring information to light, you just will not be allowed. The plug will be pulled on dissenting voices.
And it was interesting. There was a Globe and Mail article which talked about some comment that Prime Minister Castro had made regarding the dysfunction of Parliament, and they alluded to the fact maybe this means that there's a fall election coming, which I thought was just the most ridiculous piece of journalism. I mean, why would he go to an election when he has an indefinite term now, number one, and number two, if Parliament is dysfunctional, I would think that his move is just to simply say, "You guys stay home. We're going to run this from cabinet, and you have nothing to say." I mean, that to me is a more logical outcome based on what we've seen over the last few years versus him going to the polls. That doesn't make any sense. So I think that again is some misinformation from our mainstream media to kind of play up the fact that things aren't as bad as they really are.
I think there's a tremendous advantage of going to the polls in the fall. And I think the advantage for him is that between now and then, a lot of information can come to light. A lot of truth can be exposed. And if that happens between now and then, they will tank in the polls. So if it's possible that the narrative can fracture and truth's going to come out, let's get reelected before it does.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. And of course, in terms of these, these truth bombs, which are slowly poking their way forward, we have the situation of Parliament hiding the entire situation at the Winnipeg Virology Lab and these potential Chinese spies. Whether they're spies or not, I mean, they certainly look like they're CCP card-carrying members. And there was some other information there in terms of material being smuggled back to Wuhan from these labs. I mean, this is a as the more I dig into this, which I've just started to over the last couple of days, I mean, this is an entirely bizarre situation. And the fact that the government is responding in the way they have tells me that there's more going on here than what they want the public knowing about.
Yeah, that's true. And when this was all going on, I mean, we also had there was tremendous censorship in the US during the last presidential election when this information first came to light. But they got their way and they now have the president they want. On that subject, do you know who the one person is in the US that says President Harris the most frequently? And that would be Joe Biden.
I was going to say, the Vice President Biden.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that was a big thing. And now that it's over, the election's over, and they have actually gotten what they really need for power and control within the US, their media, the strings on their media can be somewhat relaxed. And so this issue about what went on in Canada with the lab in Manitoba, that could come out, and that may not fly in Canada. That may be suppressed in Canada through the mainstream media, but that could start flying across US media. And again, that's another reason why there may be an election called, because if that information gets out, which it already has gotten out, it just hasn't gotten out to the masses. The information is there, it's been exposed, and it's very damaging for the government. So would that make it to mainstream? The political views of the citizens within this country will change significantly.
And then I just before we got on air, I read a piece that said that there was, and it's actually a confidentiality agreement which was released to the press in the US about the Moderna vaccines in a trial state being shipped to a North Carolina university in October of 2019, obviously predating the official release of the pandemic and kind of coinciding with Event 201. So this is, the evidence is really stacking up now that there was much more knowledge of what was happening in China, and and or the plot entirely moving forward. And then we see the recent resignation of Warren Buffett from the Gates Foundation. So, there's definitely some moves afoot here in terms of, who did what when. It may all come to light here.
That's very true. And I think what you were alluding to is also there was a doctor, I don't recall his name, but he was, there were some emails that indicated Fauci and this other doctor were having a conversation back in December of 2019, December of 2019, about the vaccine that had been developed for this flu. And that's just amazing that it hasn't even come to the continent yet, and you're discussing the COVID-19 vaccine that has already been developed.
Well, and of course, then you go backwards a little further to Fauci's statement that there will be, not that there may be, or there's a potential, there will be a pandemic in this administration. So, I mean, that's an interesting, maybe it's a Freudian slip, or maybe it was a little foreshadowing in terms of what was to come. A bit of bragging on the pulpit there, the press release, but the things are not looking good for Mr. Fauci and the official narrative at this point. Whether
Well,
that narrative, yeah, sorry, whether
that's
that
certain.
narrative
That's
makes light of day here in Canada is a different story, which seems like we're kind of, or the average Canadian is getting a very misguided narrative from the official sources.
That's circumstantial evidence, but circumstantial evidence is evidence. And when there's overwhelming circumstantial evidence, it all has to be individually weighted. But when you have a significant amount of coincidence, a significant amount of circumstantial evidence, a significant amount of documentary evidence, put it all together, this really does spell out the real recipe behind why we're in this mess, and why we haven't been able to get out of this mess, and as well as how we allow ourselves to get into this problem in the first place, which eventually leads to a lack of accountability. There's just no enforcement of the people at the top of the food chain.
No. And of course, again, with that situation in Winnipeg, the Parliament banned the publication of certain documents, which I guess is somewhat of an unprecedented move as a parliamentary decision. And I know that's caused some concern amongst some senators. And so, we'll see how that unfolds. But I mean, there's obviously some damaging information there that's being withheld. And how we get to access that information, I mean, I guess that's more a job for law enforcement at this point. I mean, it's where is the RCMP in all this as they sit there watching what's going on? And as you mentioned, there just seems to be a complete lack of accountability at that top end. And that would be the same goes right back to that SNC-Lavalin situation where, I think there was some criminality going on there, and the RCMP looked elected to look the other way.
Yeah, so the two words that really come to mind are not only the lack of accountability. So we have accountability, and we also have suppression within the police agency. You need to look to who would the designated police agency be to deal with this issue. And then, have they been provided with information? Why are they not acting on this information? So there's suppression. And where is that suppression coming from? And usually I'll find within police agencies, so I like to use Metro Toronto Police as an example because they're the largest municipal agency. The Ontario Provincial Police is a provincial agency, and then and it's quite large. And then the RCMP, it being a federal agency. So who appoints those people at the top of the agency? So it works the same on all three levels. And I'm going to use Metro Toronto as a really good example right now, because for the last year and a half since this all started up, the chief had left. He retired early. And you no longer have a chief right now. You have an acting chief. And the mayor and the police services board will eventually make a decision as to who they're going to put in place. And I can tell you at that level in policing, it is very political, and it's a hunger game. You have a lot of people who are vying for that position, who want that position very bad. So are you going to be somebody near the top of the food chain who does not do what your mayor or your police services board is dictating to you? Because then you're not going to be anyone who's going to be on the top list for selection. So there's a lot of hunger right now for people to make their mayor very happy, make their police services board very happy, do what they want you to do at all costs so that you'll be the chosen one. And that needs to be looked at on a provincial level and on a federal level as well. So, why was a certain individual chosen as the chief? And what type of connection is there between the chief and the mayor, or the chief and the commissioner and the premier, or the commissioner of the federal agency to the prime minister? And there are very deep connections to these individuals. And so when the people at the top are getting themselves into trouble, like the SNC-Lavalin scandal, like the WE scandal, where there's either an indication of criminal activity and or in the one case of the SNC scandal, an obstruction of justice. And if there's at least indication, then there should be an investigation. And if the investigation and information provided reveals that no charges will be laid based on this information, so be it. And if they're unsure, but they have information to go on, if there's information to go on to proceed with a criminal charge, then you lay it and you let the courts decide and put it into the courts. But we're not seeing that. We're not seeing that on any level. And this is really throwing Canada into a very, very dark hole right now, because we're having the police agencies, whether they're municipal, provincial, or federal, really spiraling out of control, performing the requests of the people at the top within those areas. And that's not necessarily a good thing. It's really politicized policing is what it's done.
And I mean, and I guess in a word, you could define that as corruption. I mean, that's essentially what it is. Whether, it's not in the classic sense that somebody's getting an envelope or a briefcase of money, but in return for your fealty, I will give you a job because I know that you're my lapdog and you will do whatever I tell you to do.
Well, it's the makings of a corrupt system, not pointing to any particular individual, but saying, if you have a system that operates that way, then the system is corrupt, because that's not the way the system is intended to work. The system is intended to really maintain justice at all levels, not just anybody below the rank of inspector or below. You're subject to enforcement action if you did something, but people at the higher levels, they're just not investigated. Likewise, politicians are not investigated. So that needs to stop. When information comes forward, investigations need to roll out, and the courts need to decide on issues of wrongdoing.
Now, and in terms of the courts, I mean, they seem to have been absent by and large through this whole process, although we recently had a ruling coming out, with the JCCF's action on the travel restrictions and the emergency order prohibiting Canadians from traveling. That case was not won by the JCCF, and I think they went about it in a bad way in terms of just arguing on law as opposed to arguing the fact that there is no pandemic and providing expert testimony to prove that from the data and the statistics. You know, have you followed that case at all and any thoughts on how that's turned out?
Yeah, I followed the process, and the process, it is a very difficult one to prove, because if the council is going to make an argument on the pandemic and trying to disprove a lot of the issues in the pandemic, then the case isn't going to be one based on documentary submission. It's going to be one on bringing in expert witnesses in the field. And that's what's required. You really need to bring in those brightest, smartest individuals that are speaking the truth with their professional designations and have them come into the courtroom and explain to the judge. You know, by submitting articles, it doesn't really get you very far. Now, that being said, it's the weight of the evidence. So there are articles that can be submitted to that degree, and there are a number of peer-reviewed published articles that are extremely supportive of that issue that we're talking about. And I'll use Elmer, Ontario, as an example, where the Church of God was in court and submissions were made by the Church of God and by their council that outlined all the documentation about the death rate, PCR testing, case counts. All of this information was provided in a professional manner by expert submissions of documentation to the judge to review. And there was quite a bit, a substantial amount of supportive documentation on those issues that you spoke about that this really isn't what the media is proclaiming it to be. And the prosecution submitted nothing. The prosecutor didn't submit any documents to counter any of that. And the judge recessed for 2 weeks, reviewed all the information, and came back and made a decision against the church. And you'd think to yourself, how is that possible when they've provided all the documentation? How is it that they did not fare well in this trial? And the answer really is the judge's prerogative as to how much weight he's going to put on the documentary submission. Now, it would have been much more supportive to have professionals come and testify on that case as to what's going on in the medical field and have more testimonial evidence from experts than just submitting documents.
Except if the fact that the judge receives a phone call from one of the higher ups and says, "Oh, good afternoon, Your Honor. How's that case going? You know, make sure that the result is X. Yes, sir. Three bags full, sir. You can count on me, sir."
Well, we don't have any indication or evidence that that's what happened, so I wouldn't speculate on that. But what I will say is that there was a conviction and there was all kinds of supporting documentation to prove their case, and there was no supportive documentation from the prosecution. So I'm at a loss to explain how there was a conviction. But your analysis or belief on that sounds very plausible.
It's a scary point if that's what we've gone to here. And we chatted yesterday off air there regarding your the saga of you trying to being served for your COVID fines. You care to share that story and the sort of the outcome of your discussion with the service gentleman?
Well, I guess there's been a service that's coming to my door on a regular basis trying to serve me with some documentation, and have reached out that they're trying to serve me with some documentation, and have phoned me and told me they're trying to serve me with some documentation. And I then receive a call from a staff sergeant who was wanting to discuss this issue. Very, very, it was very kind and polite, and actually quite a favorable conversation that we had, because we did speak on many issues. But it was the issue of service of this documentation. That's how it started out with. And I reminded the officer that I'm under no obligation to make myself available to court services for their trying to serve me some documentation, which turns out to be a charge for having gone to church. So under the Reopening Act of Ontario, my first charge will be after 32 years of police service, will be having gone to church. So they're trying to serve me a summons on that. So I welcome them to come here. I understand they work Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, and I'm not here during those times. So if they want to come here at some later evening date or when I would be here, but they don't work those times. They only work during business hours. Yet I'm not required to put myself in a position to be available to them. They are required to serve the documentation, and they can continue to make efforts and attempts to do so. And so what can happen as a result of inevitably the charges can go back to the initiating police agency because it occurred in a different jurisdiction. And that agency can choose to have a warrant issued at some point if there was evidence to indicate I'm evading the service. Of course, I'm not evading the service. I'm just not here. Just can't, and I'm under no obligation to put myself here, have to put myself here. So if a warrant's issued, then so be it. I would probably be the first person in Canada that has a warrant for my arrest for having attended church.
Well, and that's a dangerous precedent to be setting if that's if that actually comes to pass.
Yeah, correct. Correct.
Interesting. And we've heard some ruminations here the last week or so about the potential opening of the US-Canada border. The most recent reopening statement revolves around vaccination rates. And it's interesting, a couple of weeks ago, 2, 3 weeks ago now, the opening date was early July, and now it's been pushed to late in July. What are your thoughts as to when the border may be reopened, and why would the feds reopen the border at this point?
That's a good question. Well, we don't know how and why the feds do anything they do. Do I see the border opening? Well, if there's been some discussion at the last summit, clearly the answer would have come from that summit discussion. And what the actual answer is, we don't know, but they clearly do know when they're going to open it up. And clearly it's going to open up initially for, or at least it is going to open up for those that have been vaccinated. And how it's going to play out, nobody knows, but there is the carrot and stick incentivization for, get your jab. And I shouldn't even call it vaccinated. I don't know why I use that word. It's not a vaccine. It's an experimental process. So, take your experimental process concoction cocktail, and you'll have more privileges.
Yeah.
Why anybody would want to do that, I don't know.
Well, and we haven't kind of touched on the whole vaccine issue. I've covered it extensively in the last couple episodes, and I've got Dr. Peter McCullough coming on next week. And the authorities in or the those who have a real opinion on the subject are really raising the alarm bells now. Peter McCullough is now describing this as a bioterrorist weapon. The virus is phase one and phase two is the vaccine. And based on what we've seen over the last 6 months here, I mean, this thing is killing people. The WHO has now come out and said that children should not be vaccinated, yet we have the Canadian government pushing for children as young as 12 without parental consent or to be vaccinated. I mean, we have a real problem here. And the potential downside, I mean, we don't know what's going to happen, but the potential downside here could be a catastrophic problem. I hope that it's not as bad as what it might be, and that one way or another, all of these officials in power who have been pushing this and mandating this are held accountable for their actions in, something akin to a Nuremberg trial. I mean, this now is in violation of everything the Nuremberg Code has put out. It's probably a violation of medical ethics. We've had the Ontario doctors come out just recently with that press conference with Derek Sloan, again, where the Ontario College of Physicians and Surgeons has mandated that speaking about vitamin D as a prophylactic for COVID is not permitted. And that's simply a ridiculous statement. And the Canadians need to be worried about what this, what are the authorities trying to do here with this entire process?
Well, clearly on this issue, this is a hot boiling pot, and it's got a lid on it. And it's getting hotter, and it's getting harder and harder to keep that lid on. And I suspect the manner in which we're seeing information roll out is really turning the heat up. And I think the lid is going to blow right off that pot. I really do. I suspect that those within the media, even though they're all getting paid by the government, they're on the government dime, I think they realize that the money that we're taking is one thing. But considering how information is being placed right in front of us and spoon-fed to us by multiple sources, if we continue to try to keep the lid on this pot, we will be complicit in this. And imagine how many deaths, how many families will hold accountable or responsible the media, who they would find out knew the information that was provided to them from multiple sources, choose not to run that information, choose to withhold it from the public. The amount of devastation that's going to occur, and it's happening already, the accountability is why the lid needs to come off the pot. And I think it will come off the pot shortly. And that's another fantastic reason for the government holding an election very quickly, is get us elected before the lid comes off the pot.
Right. Yeah, and that of course is a great segue into these vaccine passports, which, 3 months ago would never happen, and now they're happening. And obviously out of the gate here, if it's a non-digital passport where you simply show your paper card, that may, that's sort of phase one. But phase two, once this goes into some form of a digital passport, a social credit system is right behind it. I mean, that's I think anybody that doesn't see that or doesn't accept that is again has their head in the sand. I mean, that's pretty much where things are going at that point.
So you can imagine if the lid comes off the pot and the dangers of the vaccine are exposed, the entire set of dominoes leading to the vaccine passport, that's going to fall as well. And then it's all going to fall. The whole house of cards are going to come right down.
Yes. And you'd mentioned that you'd seen some research out of China that indicates that they're predicting a massive decline in birth rates, potentially due to this virus or the vaccine. Can you share some more details on that for us?
Yeah, I don't recall all the details, but it was a shorter report that was indicating the problems and concerns in China with the expected drop, substantial drop in the birth rate. So I think they're starting to see blood clotting in China as well, and that could lead in females. That's going to lead to significant the birth rate decline with
Yeah, and it certainly looks like that spike protein and its ability to attach the ACE2 receptor, the uterus and the endometrium lining is very, very rich in these ACE2 receptors. And with that spike protein circulating, that's simply a signal to flush that lining. And so, conception may become a problem. And God knows the it looks like the that Japanese rat study from Pfizer vaccine showing the accumulation in the spleen and the ovaries. There's reason for grave concern here, and hopefully the pot blows off the lid, as you say, and people begin to wake up. And I think there's going to be a lot of parents that are going to have a tough time looking in the mirror that have vaccinated their kids or vaccinated themselves. And I'm not sure what a parent, you look in the mirror and you've elected to vaccinate your 14-year-old daughter or son, and you've just eliminated your possibility to become a grandparent. I mean, how do you rationalize that in your mind? I mean, there's going to be some really long faces here over the next few months if this pot blows off and people become aware of what their actions have or can manifest as.
Well, it seems what's happening here locally in our own health center, from people that I've spoken to that work at the hospitals and some of the doctors on this issue, have indicated that they're seeing a lot of patients that come in with problems that do not at all correlate or understand the correlation between the problems they're having and the fact that they were just vaccinated in the last 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. They don't get it. They don't understand it. They just say, I'm coming in. I'm now reporting in with this problem. And it's not until the doctor says, have you been vaccinated? Oh, yeah, I was vaccinated 3 weeks ago, or I was vaccinated 4 weeks ago. The patients themselves aren't really putting together, they see the vaccination as being something that's going to help them, and they don't think that there's any correlation between the health issue that they're dealing with. And that's going to take time. And once people start to understand that there are certain illnesses developing as a result of this vaccination, they're going to start to put the pieces of the puzzle together. And that'll help precipitate the lid blowing off the pot. That's my belief.
Dr. Stephanie Seneff earlier in the week had uncovered a very interesting bit of information from the CDC, which they had a there's about 300 or so deaths daily that are attributed to sort of unknown causes, and that's of the list of potential problems or causes of death. This is unsure, none of the above. And almost lockstep with the increase in vaccination rates, this curve increases, and now we're at around 3,000 deaths of just multiple organ failures of the symptoms which are presenting themselves, which nobody can clearly put a finger on as yes, this was a stroke, yes, this was a heart attack, or just these strange multiple pathways to death or morbidity. And this is a tenfold increase, which is moving lockstep with the vaccination rates. So maybe that's also similar to case to what you're seeing in your health region there. And if this continues, we're in for a real problem.
Well, I had a question to a couple of the doctors that I spoke with here locally, and I was very surprised at the answer. And the question being, when they're doing a diagnosis and they look at the patient's chart, there's nowhere on the chart in the diagnosis initially of a patient that they're seeing for the first time. There's nowhere on that chart that indicates currently vaccinated or not. So it's not unless the doctor says, have you been vaccinated recently, that there's going to be the understanding of a correlation. So can you imagine that, with what we're dealing with now, that you present to a hospital and they're going to take your vital information down and look at some history, or you want any drugs, medication. There's nowhere on that chart to say, have you been vaccinated recently? So
But of course, the official
you're not
narrative.
asking the question, yeah.
Yeah, of course, the
You're
official
not asking the
narrative.
question, you're not going to get it.
No, and of course, the official version is that many of these complications have nothing to do with the vaccine. So I'd be surprised if there's amongst most doctors, there's probably going to be resistance to even ask that question.
Correct.
So yeah, that's interesting. That'll be something to keep an eye on in terms of how that situation unfolds here. Especially as we move into our more classic fall cold and flu season, this antibody dependent enhancement that we may or we're witnessing already, we may actually bear witness to bodies in the street and massive death rate here. I hope that doesn't happen, but that's we're certainly painting the picture or the potentiality of that happening this fall.
Well, would you not think, as a non-medical person, just the administrative side of patients going into a hospital, given what we're dealing with, do you not think that on the form that takes your information and your drug history, do you not think there should be a check mark on the form that says recently vaccinated, or what was the date of the vaccination, or what vaccine did you get, or a little more information on which one did you take, when did you take it? Nothing. Nothing on the form.
Well,
Because then that's going to present a problem with tracking history of, okay, is there a correlation? Why is that? Does that not surprise somebody?
vaccines are safe and effective, Vincent. So clearly that's that would be misguided use of resources.
You just can't believe that your minister of health within your province would not have, notified the hospitals to say, hey, we need to track this just because it's experimental. Let's see how this rolls out. No, it's not even on the chart.
And that is, I mean, that's an excellent point that we've moved from this emergency use authorization to, you know, almost immediately with no kind of oversight or checks and balances or monitoring to this, you know, ubiquitous statement that these are safe and effective. And, you know, the ridiculous statement of whichever vaccine is offered to you first is the best one for you to take. I mean, that's just, you know, I don't think we've ever heard a statement like that ever in history.
And if you go see your doctor and you say, I need a prescription for whatever, or he or she decides to prescribe you something, that'll be charted and that'll be on your medical history, right? But yes. if you walk into a clinic and you get your vaccine shot at a clinic, that doesn't go on your history. That doesn't go on your medical history.
Is that a fact? I thought that would have been recorded for sure. You know, who got what vaccine? I mean, how are they going to implement this vaccine passport then?
Well, they'll keep the government can keep a independent provincial file on that particular vaccine, initially they'll issue you a piece of paper that says you were vaccinated. Here's your official chart. But, you know, that's going to be addressed now on this rollout of the vaccine passport. There'll be some integral system, but currently, imagine this, you're trying to figure out how to have a system of accountability that you've been vaccinated, but let's not tie it to your health records or your health chart. Let's do it somewhere else so that when a doctor's trying to figure out what's wrong with you, there's nothing there on your chart that indicates you were at a pharmacy last week and you got a shot.
I mean, that's almost potentially by purpose, by design.
It's just highly suspicious. It's just highly suspicious that if you're taking a product, whether it's experimental or not, you would think that anytime you get a vaccine somewhere, that should be charted as part of, you know, this is part of my health history of something that I took, and it's not.
That's a very, that's
that
very
a liability
important point.
Issue.
I agree. I mean, it's particularly with this emergency youth authorization and the fact that we are in a grand phase 3 medical human experiment, you would imagine that they'd want to track that even more so for the data points. And the fact that that's not, you know, the only real data point that a person would have is in that vaccine card. That's interesting.
I'm sure it'll be charted if you go to your family physician and you get your shot from your family physician. I'm sure that will go on your physician's records. But then again, that's not something that, depending on your province, that's not something that's shared with all health providers or health facilities. Right. But certainly when you're going to a clinic, and I know they had this problem in the US, when you're going to a CVS pharmacy to get your shot there, then there's no recording of that on your health record. It's just, you got your shot. Here's a piece of paper that says you got your shot and see you later. Thanks.
That seems like an absolute abdication of responsibility on the government on the basis of that this is an experimental product. I mean, how are they going to remove this emergency youth authorization if they don't have data to support the safety or efficacy of that? How many people received what shot? You know, how many of those people had certain reactions versus, you know, is one product better than the other? Or, I mean, based on your summation there, they simply don't care. They're pushing forward regardless of what the results are. And the net results are going to be rubber stamped, it sounds like, one way or another.
I mean, the whole notion, don't get me wrong, the whole notion of a vaccine passport or a recording system of your vaccinations, would you have gotten a vaccine that is exceptionally safe and exceptionally effective would be a different story. And that could have really helped to roll out this mandate. But when it's experimental, it does not currently appear to be safe. It is not effective whatsoever. You know, it's a different product. It's a different cat altogether.
That's an interesting revelation, Vincent. And then lastly, before we conclude, I'm bearing witness here to the beginnings of what might become a mass exodus of concerned citizens in Canada. Are you seeing a similar trend in your neck of the woods there?
Absolutely. It's probably the hottest conversation in Ontario right now amongst everybody that I know. There are a number of people that have already left. They've packed and sold their home and they've left. There are people that are talking about leaving, and that is a huge conversation that's taking place right now. And it's a complex issue, and it's one that needs to be discussed in great detail. But if Canada is no longer going to be Canada, I mean, I've had this conversation with quite a few people already. And my personal take on this is that I'm waiting to see some outcomes from the Supreme Court. If the Supreme Court rules favorably to our rights violations issues and can really tame the government on its abuses, then I think we'll get things under control. But if the Supreme Court does not rule favorably and essentially gives a green light to the government to continue operating in the mode in which it is, then it's time to pack up and go. The biggest question is go where? What other country are you going to go to? Canada, up until a year ago, was, in my opinion, one of the greatest places to live in the world. But we are no longer what we were a year ago. So it's time to rethink the strategy and think maybe it will be, depending on these Supreme Court decisions, time to find another place to go.
Yeah, I mean, and the only risk there, waiting until that period of time, is the Iron Curtain may come down, and there may be very difficult to leave.
Correct. That's part of the conversation, is that it may be. The other issue is what we're seeing spreading across the Commonwealth and Western nations. I mean, Canada is the same as the UK, is the same as Australia, or the same as New Zealand. We're all in the same boat, so I wouldn't leave to any of those countries. But if things were to change significantly in the Western nations, then we have a complete power shift across the globe. And who's to believe that it would be safe to live in Costa Rica or Mexico or Ecuador or some nice, hot, sunny southern destination before the governments, the Marxist forces across Western nations, then eventually start slipping across other parts of the world, and before you know it, you're not safe anywhere. So I'm not sure what the answer is as to where to go. There are many wonderful destinations in mind. It's a question of how long will you be safe there as well.
Yeah, I agree. And an interesting metric that's just come up is the lack of availability and the cost of shipping containers. So my colleague Mitch Carlson there, who is one of the Exodus crew, he's on his way to Costa Rica. He's sold his place here and he's off headed south. He just purchased a 40-foot container, which cost him $8,400. And it wasn't too long ago that that was more in the, high threes, low fours range. And he spent quite a bit of time most of the afternoon going through, online listing of making phone calls of seeing who had what available. And the gentleman, I think it was in Kamloops that he found that container. And he basically said, look, if you don't buy this right now, the next phone call that I receive maybe from somebody who will buy it. That's kind of the day that I've been having. And so Mitch just said, yeah, I'll take it. And it showed up, 2 days later. But that's an interesting, I'm not sure if that's simply because of the demand of people packing up and going, or if there's something else afoot there, which is limiting the availability of these containers. I mean, certainly I would imagine that the amount of goods which are moving from China to North America are reduced. So maybe there's a lot of empty containers sitting on that side versus here, and there's just simply not enough transport. But that's, it's an interesting measure of what we're talking about in terms of exodus from a nation if there's no shipping containers available.
Well, I had heard a similar story 2 or 3 months ago, and it didn't deal with shipping containers. It actually dealt with ships. And
Okay.
the problem was there's a corporation that needed product from China as a result of the when everything was locked down last year, and then things started to open up and production started to increase. Think of it as a rubber band. There's some elasticity in terms of availability and production, and then things come to a grinding halt, and then all of a sudden everybody wants product again. Okay, so apparently they requested product from China, and the Chinese had indicated, we can get you the product, we just can't get it to you. We can produce it because there's no ships available. And so the statement made was, well, we'll pay double to have it shipped. We'll just pay double whatever we normally pay. And the answer was, it doesn't matter what you pay, there just aren't ships available. Like, we just don't have enough ships. The demand is so high in delivery of product, we just can't get a ship to put it on. We have to wait 3 months or 4 months, or there's going to be a tremendous delay to get you this product before the available shipping comes available. So I'm sure there's a tie-in with shipping containers as well as this. This could be a different problem altogether, but apparently China is producing so rapidly right now. There is so much production going on that they just can't keep up. And this is a unprecedented amount of backlog. I think they had sort of prepared for, what would be a daily, weekly, regular shipping volume, and then the volume stopped and all the ships were parked, doing nothing, and now they can't get enough ships. So there may be a correlation between that.
And certainly I think we may see a similar situation for the demand on petroleum as things ramp back up, and especially with the what they call the summer driving season. America is pretty much 100% back to normal at this point. And so we may there may be some price shock at the pump here over the next couple of months. Particularly in Canada, as we've sort of mothballed a lot of production and things are, it's going to take some time to get that production back online. I have a few colleagues that have now invested heavily into oil producers because they feel the price is really going to spike here, particularly in the, short to medium term.
We just can't put up a few more windmills and heat our homes and power all our cars that way.
Now, in fact, I think there should actually be a tax on electric vehicles, and if you want to buy one, you should have to have your own solar panels to limit your draw from the grid for that silly technology. But that's another point entirely.
It is. It is. It's a substantial conversation that we've been having for years already, and it's one that has never proven its point, but most of the people think that it's a great thing. I don't understand it.
It's a strange one. Well, sir, it's been a pleasure again. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with us today. It's always great to speak with you, and hopefully some of the insights you've provided will be shared with our listeners to regular Canadians, and they can start to open up their minds and brains and hearts to what's going on here. And when you're trying to serve a 30-year veteran of the police force with a violation ticket for going to church, I think that pretty much sums up everything that's wrong in Canada at the present state of affairs here.
Well, it's always a pleasure speaking with you, Michael.
Excellent, sir. Well, you have yourself a great day, and if you figure out where is safe to go, you let me know, and I'll be exploring that option as well.
Yeah, we might end up at the same place.
That wouldn't be so bad. Fantastic,
Take care, my
sir.
friend.
Thank you. Bye-bye.